Thank you. Today I'll be talking about small-scale experiments and how they can look for new phenomena beyond the standard model. So by small, I mean things that could possibly fit on a tabletop. And so the outline of the talk is first I'll give some context, including some historical context. Then I'll talk a little bit about what the theoretical targets are that we're after. So, you know, what exactly are the new phenomena that we're looking for? And then some classification of the types of experimental strategies that one would use to look for these targets. And then, so that's mostly overview. And then I'd like to finish in the last 15 minutes or so with a rather technical point, which is common among all of these experimental strategies. I cannot possibly cover every single experiment for every single theoretical target, but one thing that's common for all of these experiments is noise. So it's not exactly a sexy topic, but it's a very important one. And it's one that affects most of them. So, and the type of noise that I'll be talking about is thermal noise, or at zero temperature, the standard quantum limit. And so even me as a theorist, I can derive how much noise there is in any experiment with a formula, which is the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And even though it's a rather technical point, I thought it'd be kind of appropriate because the boundary layer program thinks about dissipation all the time, and the cold dark matter program thinks about density fluctuations in the early universe all the time. And also, I think this fluctuation dissipation theorem was not known. Is not known to many theorists, including myself a few years ago, so that's fine. Okay, so first some context. So we can usually divide new fundamental physics experiments into four categories, or four frontiers. The classic one is the high energy frontier, like the LHC, where we create an extremely high energy environment in the lab. The second frontier is the cosmic frontier, where we observe extreme environments on cosmological or astral scales. Extreme in the sense that they are at very high abundance, or are very large length scales, or also at very high energies or temperatures, or strong gravity, for example. And so that's the topic of the cold dark matter conference is, I'd say, at this frontier. And then there are two more frontiers, the intensity frontier and the precision or the sensitivity frontier that have recently regained some interest. So at the intensity frontier, we look for extremely rare events in the laboratory that are fairly distinctive. So we can pick up individual events, and typically, I would say, phenomena with an energy scale above 10 electron volts, I would classify at the intensity frontier. So examples are direct dark matter detection, where a weakly interacting massive particle ionizes a xenon atom, proton decay experiments, or neutrino-less double beta decay, I would put it in this frontier. At the sensitivity frontier, we're looking for extremely weak effects at an energy scale below 10 eV. And this 10 eV is just roughly speaking because you can't ionize an atom or a molecule at this scale. So you'd like to do low energy experiments. And so roughly the lower boundary here is 10 to the minus 22 eV. So it's quite a wide range of energies. And this is roughly the scale where the time constant associated with this energy scale is on the order of a year or so, or a few years. Okay, so that's the classification. I'll be talking about the sensitivity frontier. And so let me give you a little bit of history to illustrate some of my points. So the sensitivity frontier started when physics experiments in the modern sense started to happen. So Galileo rolling balls down inclined planes, in effect, he was testing the weak equivalence principle, or the fact that gravity is composition independent. Then a century later, Cavendish tested gravity down to the centimeter scale in the lab, I think 1798. So he tested GR, or gravity, at short distances. So these are, of course, not inclusive, but I will just give four classic experiments. And so another famous one is the Michelson and Morley experiment in 1887 that tested that the frame independence of the speed of light. And then in the last century, Smith, Purcell, and Ramsey in 1957 did a classic experiment, and they determined that the electric dipole moment of the neutron in absolute value is less than 5 times 10 to the minus 20 electron charges times centimeter. So these four experiments will illustrate some of the points later. They fundamentally guided our theory. So Galileo, in a sense, already measured that gravity is a metric theory of gravity. Cavendish tested gravity on a scale that was previously not tested before. So in our current interpretation, Cavendish was actually already looking for large extra dimensions at the centimeter scale. Michelson and Morley, of course, radically changed our understanding of space-time. And even though Smith, Purcell, and Ramsey didn't know it at the time, they actually, this bound motivates searches for QCD axions, because it's much smaller than what we naively would expect. Okay, so that's the historical context. So what are the targets we're after? So probably the most motivated target is dark matter. So dark matter is non-relativistic, so the energy associated with the dark matter particle is mostly its rest mass energy. So the rest mass energy has to be less than 10 eV if I am to look for it at the sensitivity frontier. And particles that can be this light are axions, so the very same particles that are motivated by this bound. So these are spin zero particles that have odd under parity. There's moduli, so these are also spin zero particles, but they're parity even. And then there's vector analogs that are usually called dark photons or hidden photons. And then you can go up and spin and look for spin 2 particles, but those are usually more problematic. So that's dark matter. We can also look for massless spin 2 particles, just the ordinary gravitational waves. And then there's more crazy things like the cosmic neutrino background, so the afterglow of the Big Bang in neutrinos instead of photons, or anything crazy, anything that we didn't expect before. As you can tell, all these guys weren't looking for any specific particle, But they tested the fundamental symmetries of nature. So Right. So what are the types of effects that you can generate? So, for example, axion dark matter, what it does, or one of the things it can do, is if you set up a static B field in the lab, let's say with some solenoid, you create a B field in the lab. If now there's a background of axion particles propagating through this magnetic field, what it does is it generates an azimuthal B field around this in the solenoidal magnetic field that oscillates at a frequency given by the mass of this axion field, and the magnitude is roughly some small numerical factor, so the fine structure constant over 2 pi, that's around 10 to the minus 3. It's proportional to the amplitude in this field over some decay constant, F or FA, times some suppression factor, which can be close to 1. Basically, if the Compton wavelength matches the size of this B field, the size L of this B field, this can be of order 1, and then it's times the background B field. So that's roughly the size of the effect we're going after. So you try to detect this oscillating B field, and then you can indirectly detect the axion. The problem is that this B field is tiny, so alpha over 2 pi is about 10 to the minus 3. For this QCD axion that's motivated by the smallness of the neutron EDM, you can actually work out that a dark matter background gives an amplitude of 10 to the minus 19 for this ratio. And this factor M times L can be 1, but it can also be much smaller than 1. So you're looking for, in a 10 Tesla field, you're looking for B fields of order 10 to the minus 21 Tesla or smaller. Right. And so, sorry, I think I skipped over this. So the reason why this experiment motivated the QCD axion is that if CP symmetry is violated, then a neutron EDM is generally expected to be of order some angle theta, which in the standard model we expect it to be order 1, times about 2 times 10 to the minus 16 E centimeters. So the fact that Smith, Purcell, and Ramsey found 10 to the minus 20 already motivated, some weird dynamics going on. And since then, the bound is much tighter, so of order 10 to the minus 26. And actually, there's a really cool paragraph in their paper that motivates looking for crazy unexpected things. So let me paraphrase a little bit. So they say in 1957, when parity violation in the standard model was just found to occur, their paper starts off with, and I quote, "The usual parity argument for the non-existence of electric dipole moments for elementary particles, although appealing from the point of view of symmetry, are not necessarily valid. The validity of the parity assumption must rest on experimental evidence, which is currently not as conclusive as generally supposed." So they say, well, at the time, CP violation had not been seen, but they said it might be violated, so let's look for it. And they didn't see any CP violation, but later they found CP violation in the standard model, and unknowingly they already put this bound on this theta parameter. So, anyway. Okay, so this motivated axions, which can give tiny effects. Moduli are somewhat similar. What they do is they can make these particles set the masses and couplings of the standard model. They don't have to exist, but they could. And so they would, if there's a dark matter background, they would cause fractional changes of masses and couplings, and they would be on the order of some dimensionless coupling D times the amplitude of the field over M Planck. It's similar. So the interactions are suppressed by some heavy mass scale. Here I call it M Planck over this coupling constant. And this amplitude is about 10 to the minus 15 if the mass is 10 to the minus 15 eV. So that's two times 10 to the minus 15 is easy to remember. So 10 to the minus 15 eV, this would cause roughly 1 hertz oscillations. That's this factor here. So your signal would oscillate at 1 hertz. So these are very low frequency experiments that you would do. Gravitational waves, as you probably all know, you can generate from an oscillating a second time derivative of a quadrupole moment, and it's suppressed by 1 over the distance to your source. So famously, if for two black holes of, let's say, 10 solar masses, right before they merge, you get that the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment is roughly just the rest mass energy, the total rest mass energy of the system divided by the distance. So if it's at 400 megaparsec or so, you get a 10 to the minus 21 strain. So generally speaking, you're looking for effects that are 10 to the minus 20 times the natural size of the system, size in magnetic field or in physical distance. But there might be some other things you can look for.
What's oscillating against the moduli?
So the field. So it's to leading approximation, a modulus is just a free scalar field. It can be non-thermally produced in the early universe. Its energy density is just some harmonic potential, and so there could be energy stored in the oscillations of this field. Think of it as an ensemble of radio waves, except these waves would be non-relativistic and B spin 0 instead of spin 1. So there's only one polarization, for example.
Measure what?
What you would measure, well, there's a variety of experiments that can look for this. So if masses change, then transition energies and atoms would change. So you can look for this effect by measuring ratios of different atomic clocks. For example, I'll give you one example. So a transition energy of an electronic transition in hydrogen scales like alpha squared times the electron mass, but a hyperfine transition, let's say in cesium, scales like alpha to the fourth times the electron mass, but is suppressed by the electron mass over the proton mass. So it goes like the electron mass squared. So if you measure, if you can compare these two transition energies, for example, by measuring their ratio, you're sensitive to this quantity. So if the electron mass were to oscillate but not the proton mass, you would measure the ticking rates of these clocks would oscillate in time themselves at low frequencies.
And you are agnostic as to what's given the moduli potential.
So one thing that gives the moduli the potential is coupling to the standard model. Once you couple the field, it'll generate a mass for that field already. But there's a variety of that gives you a correction. There's a variety of ways in which you can get masses for these fields. So that's one signature. There's a variety of other ones. Spatial gradients in the field will give rise to spatial gradients in the mass, and a spatial gradient in the mass leads to a force. So that's another thing you can look for. Yeah.
Would an axion in a static electric field generate an oscillating magnetic field?
Yes, but that effect is velocity suppressed. So you can so in the presence of an axion background, Maxwell's equations are modified. It turns out that if the velocity is much less than one, which it has to be for dark matter, this is the leading effect of this coupling to photons. The effect you're talking about would be suppressed by at least one power of V over C. And so the axion doesn't need to couple only to photons. It can couple to spins of fermions, for example. In fact, it has to couple to the nuclear dipole moments. Okay, so those are the targets you'd look for. So the type of experiments that you can use to look for these types of effects, I'll classify, again, into three categories. So the first is electromagnetic resonators. So, for example, LC circuits. LC circuits, cavities, or amplifiers. There's mechanical resonators. For example, torsion balances. Not much different from Cavendish's torsion balance. Center of mass oscillators. So we had a few talks in the last couple of weeks about center of mass oscillators would be pendula, for example, optically levitated microspheres, cantilevers, and then there's also acoustic resonances, so looking for internal modes, so acoustic phonons, so looking for vibrations in a material. One thing that a modulus could do, for example, if you change masses, you would also change in an oscillatory way the size of an atom, the equilibrium size of an atom. So if that oscillation frequency matches some acoustic resonance of a material, you can excite phonons in such a material. A gravity wave, for example, could also do the same because it changes the equilibrium size of the material. And then the third category I call AMO systems, so atomic molecular optical systems. And so examples of these are differential interferometers. You can interfere light, like LIGO does. You can interfere atoms now and a variety of other objects to look for gravitational waves, for example. So as I mentioned already, you can use atomic clocks to look for changes in fundamental constants. So not only the electron mass, but also the proton mass or alpha. And there's a variety of spin resonance techniques, like nuclear magnetic resonance or electron spin resonance. For example, this axion field can couple to electron or nuclear spins, and excite a spin resonance in a nuclear spin sample. So I may have forgotten a few experiments, but roughly these are the types of really ordinary macroscopic experiments to look for these weak effects. Any questions about this for now?
Well, I have a question about,
yeah.
Did Cavendish find anything that was different from what Galileo?
I don't think Cavendish at the time was specifically testing the composition independent nature of the gravitational force. What he was trying to measure was the gravitational force between two test masses in the laboratory. So not using the, you know, the gravitational field from the Earth itself.
Net force is usually starting out.
Yes, right. He could have done it. Cavendish used lead balls, but he could have put platinum or something and measured. I think Cavendish had 1% precision, roughly speaking. So he could have tested the equivalence principle to 1%. And now it's, of course, tested to 10 to the minus 14. And so these moduli fields would be something. Because they can couple to electrons more strongly than nuclei, they would actually modify the weak equivalence principle. So that's another way you can look for them.
Yeah.
So a dark photon would be. No, I don't have time in 45 minutes, but I can tell you quickly what it does. So, it's a kind of strange field. So it's a spin one field, and normally we think of, say, in a laser, in energy density, the electric field and the magnetic field are equal in terms of energy density. So in natural units, they have the same value. For a dark photon, because it's non-relativistic, actually the E field is larger than the B field. That's one peculiar feature. And what you can look for is, for example, if you take an experiment by Peter Graham and company, that was proposed by Peter Graham and company, that if you take a superconducting box, it's a perfect Faraday cage, what it does is if you have some new E field, that would be, the total interacting component of both the regular photon and this hidden photon would be set to zero by the superconducting boundary. But because this field has a mass and the regular photon doesn't, far away from the wall, the hidden photon has a different propagation compared to the regular photon, and the interacting component reappears inside the superconducting box. Experiments that look for dark photons are in ways very similar to these axion experiments, where you don't need a static magnetic B field. You just look for, you try to shield your sensitive magnetometer or electric field sensor as well as you can, and somehow an oscillating field appears at the frequency given by the rest mass energy. So for these particles, the frequency of the field in natural units is just the rest mass energy times some small kinetic energy correction. So in units where C is 1. So the kinetic energy is 10 to the minus 6 fractionally of the rest mass energy, because things move at 10 to the minus 3, the speed of light, locally. So what you look for is a monochromatic line, or an approximately monochromatic line, that would appear in electrical resonators or mechanical resonators, for example. Yeah. So if there's no more questions, I'll move on to my my technical point.
Maybe last question.
Sure.
Are there any astrophysical applications of these different kinds? Like, you know, can at least the most favored versions of these be different on extragalactic or galactic scales?
Right. So, for example.
From your.
So, no. So, these types of fields behave exactly the same as cold dark matter on large length scales, but on small length scale, on smaller length scales, they change structure formation. So for example, a free scalar field has an oscillating pressure, because at the top of its potential, when it's oscillating, when it's sitting at the top of its potential, it acts like dark energy. With negative pressure. If it's at the bottom of its potential, it has positive pressure. But you know, when you time average over the oscillation, the pressure is on average zero. But this oscillatory pressure gives a change in the structure formation of on small scales. So, for example, this bound that I mentioned here, this 10 to the minus 22 eV, comes from that structure formation effect. So basically, if the mass was less than 10 to the minus 22 eV, Lyman alpha structures would not have formed because of this oscillating pressure. Likewise, the potential, in particular for these axion fields, you would predict actually a cosine type potential or some periodic potential, and you would predict a negative quartic interaction, and that can also lead to effects on structure formation. So there are galactic effects just from it being a light bosonic field. Generally these couplings are too small to give you direct effects from their coupling, but maybe we forgot something.
It's actually connected to Julio's question. Is there any effect of the moduli on nucleosynthesis, for example? Because given that the effect of the oscillation of the masses.
So there is. So this coupling D is already constrained by successors to torsion balances that tested the weak equivalence principle. For example, Eric Adelberger's experiment. So if you couple to nuclei, this coupling D has to be less than 10 to the minus 5 already, so just from experimental limits. And it's true that at the time of nucleosynthesis, the density was much higher, so this amplitude was much larger. It turns out that the bound you get from nucleosynthesis is about 1 times gravity. So it's a less stringent limit than weak EP. But yes.
Are any of these experiments being done?
Yes. Right. So there are these LC circuits are being built to look for dark photons as well as low mass axions. The ADMX experiment is probably the most famous one in this category. So that's a cavity that looks for, that essentially does this experiment. Torsion balances Eric Adelberger has developed, and now he's thinking about, so he was thinking about just the static effect, the force mediation of these light fields. But he can in fact also look for a dark matter background of these fields. So these acoustic phonon detectors, these resonant mass detectors have been built to look for gravitational waves, and they have published a bound already on moduli for couplings to electrons and photons. You can use atomic clocks to look for these things as well, and there's a few published bounds already on variations in the oscillatory variations in the fine structure constant. The experiments looking for the spin coupling of an axion have been funded out as well. They're in progress. LIGO has been funded and works, as you know, and these guys are doing R&D. So atom interferometers to look for gravitational waves are. So there's been a lot of interest recently, and most of the experiments have been proposed or are being funded, but there is proofs of principle for most of them already. Yes?
So some of these are within the standard model, gravity waves, for example. Some of them are obviously outside of it, though. Things like looking for the cosmic neutrino background that's going
right.
on and the cosmic gravitational background
yes.
are also sort of within the standard model.
Right. So, but they could give hints if they're substantially different. For example, we may detect a large asymmetry in the neutrino background. Those, if we measure them, there could be hints of new physics or of a weird cosmological history, for example. That's a good point. I mean, likewise with gravitational waves, we might find gravitational waves from exotic objects or exotic histories. Okay, so then in the last 15 minutes or so, roughly. Okay. I'll go over my technical point. So as you notice, a lot of these experiments are resonant experiments. So there's a question of, is our AC experiment, is looking for AC signals always better than DC experiments? Not the musical group. And there's a technical point that even if you were looking for a DC effect, it's often better to build a resonant experiment anyway, and in fact, it's always better to take the quality factor of your resonance to be as large as possible. So the first reason is obvious, so selectivity. So often, like gravitational waves and dark matter, you know, your signal appears at one specific frequency. So if you build a resonator at the same frequency, you can filter to be sensitive only to those effects. The second reason is amplification. You know, as you know from pushing a kid on a swing, you can increase your signal over Q cycles. So you can boost your, let's say, the current in your LC circuit by a factor of Q. The third one is systematics. So in fact, these experiments that look for 10 to the minus 21 Tesla fields are not that crazy. They've in fact achieved sensitivity to those levels. But the best DC, the lowest magnetic field environment we've managed to achieve in the lab at DC is about 10 to the minus 12 Tesla. So it's much easier to get rid of systematics at high frequencies. In fact, Cavendish's torsion balance was already an AC experiment. He let his AC, he let his lead balls oscillate at the frequency of the torsional oscillator already. So these points are obvious. What I want to talk about is the fourth point, which is that higher Q lowers the noise. Lowers the thermal noise, and so I think that's a rather technical point, but a very important one. So, for example, if you had some LC circuit with a capacitor, so an inductor, a capacitor, in general, there's some losses in your system, so there's some resistor. And then you're looking for a small driving voltage, which could be, say, the EMF caused by this B field in a pickup loop. This is a resonant system. It has a resonant frequency that's 1 over square root of LC. Even if you were looking for a non-resonant signal, it makes sense to lower your resistance as low as possible. And so you can derive this with the fluctuation dissipation theorem, which is really, it's not so much a theorem as a formula that relates fluctuations in thermal equilibrium to the linear response out of equilibrium. Response. So if you know things like the resonant frequency, the Q factor of your circuit or mechanical resonator, which is the linear out of equilibrium response, you can derive what the fluctuations are in thermal equilibrium. So, for example, the smallest voltage I could possibly measure is given by this formula. So, if I know how the system dissipates energy, I know what the thermal noise voltages are here. So, I can imagine that the dissipation this resistor, dissipation this resistance means that there's some connection to a thermal bath or some external bath, and that external bath will fluctuate and that will give rise to some noise voltage V. So I can only detect signal voltages Vs that are larger than this noise voltage, and so as a theorist you can derive what the smallest fluctuations are. And so the way to do that is a kind of a long derivation, and I don't have time. But what you do is, so you parameterize this linear out of equilibrium response with some generalized impedance, which is just to say, if I push the system at with some oscillatory voltage, what is the current I get out, which is so Q is the charge on the capacitor, let's say, and V is the driving voltage. And so what this formula tells me is, for example, that the noise fluctuations as a function of frequency are given by 2 times some thermal energy, which is a function of the frequency you're looking at and the thermodynamic temperature, times the real part of the impedance. So you write the impedance as the real part, some generalized resistance, times the imaginary part, which is the reactance. For example, by the way, these are all Fourier transformed quantities. So what I mean by V of omega is the following. So it's the average Fourier amplitude. So let's say between plus and minus T over 2 dt of e to the plus I omega t of my time domain signal. And so this phi, which is the noise spectral density, this is the noise spectral density, I call, for example, for V as a function of frequency would be the integration time times this average Fourier amplitude squared. And so let's say I had a purely harmonic signal. So if my signal voltage was just say cosine omega t with let's say some frequency omega naught, then if I compute the average Fourier amplitude is constant, so that's just this amplitude here. So the power I get out in this normalization for my signal, as a function of frequency, is approximately this amplitude squared times the integration time, as long as I'm looking at frequencies less than pi over integration time, and it's zero elsewhere. But what this formula is saying is that for background, this formula is actually independent of integration time. So your average Fourier amplitude of let's say your voltage goes down as 1 over root t, and so that's compensated by this factor. And so the smallest amplitude V naught you could detect, let me call that delta V naught. So this is given by the square root of this power spectral density, let's say at the frequency of interest, omega naught, divided by the square root of the integration time. And so, for example, for an LC circuit, this epsilon is at zero temperature, is half a quantum, and at high temperature, this is just a thermodynamic temperature, whichever is larger of these two. But this is saying that, for example, for an LC circuit, your impedance is just your resistance plus, I think, I over, omega L minus 1 over omega C. Sorry. Sorry about that. So if you plug this in, what you find is that it's just, let's say, a high temperature. It's completely broadband. It's T times R. So What this means is that even though you built a resonant system, the smallest, so let's say, yeah, your noise power. Let's do the noise amplitude. Is completely flat as a function of frequency, and only at high frequencies does it scale up. So here it's proportional to omega to the 1/2 when you're at the quantum limit. But at low frequencies, this scales like square root of T over Q. This is the Q factor of your resonator, so inversely proportional to the resistance. So this is showing that that first of all, if you had perfect readouts, that a resonant system is really a broadband detector. It's not any easier. So the resonant frequency of your detector, 1 over LC, could very well be here. And so it's just as easy to detect voltages on resonance as it is off resonance if you had perfect readout. And your thermal noise goes down as you increase the quality factor of your resonance. That was the technical point that I was trying to get across, that the noise goes down if you lower the dissipation of your system. So, and heuristically, this means the lower the dissipation, the weaker the connection to the thermal bath, and thus the weaker the thermal fluctuations you have. So, for example, so how would you make this a broadband detector? So it's true that off resonance, you have a much lower, let's say, current that you generate for a given voltage, but you can always step that up with some transformer circuit. So the absolute best you can do for a quantum limited readout is roughly this thermal noise in the antenna, or the zero point noise. And in fact, this has been achieved by several cavity and LC circuit experiments, and it's been achieved. So this thermal noise limited sensitivity has been achieved for many of the mechanical resonators, in particular the famous Weber bars, over a bandwidth that was order one. Are there any questions? Also, something I forgot to mention. So if you try to determine what the lowest magnetic field is that you could possibly detect, is something we can do right now, because the voltage you generate is, let's say, if I redraw my circuit to have some pickup loop, and here I want to detect this axion B field. So this is like my inductor. Let's say I put a capacitor here. I generally have some losses. Just like I have some noise voltage here, I can think of this noise voltage as some fictitious B field noise. And so the voltage you generate is minus d by dt of magnetic field times the area of this thing. So you can, with the fluctuation dissipation theorem, you can find what this, you know, fictitious noise B field is. And if you do this, you get that this noise amplitude of this fictitious noise B field as a function of frequency is equal to 2 times the temperature times the resonant frequency of your LC circuit times the impedance over omega squared, the area of the pickup loop squared, and then the Q factor of the system. So the Q factor of the system is 1 over the resistance times L over C. And if you plug in some reasonable numbers, let's say an LC circuit with a resonant frequency of a few hundred megahertz, and if you optimize over these parameters, you get that this number at 1 Kelvin is about 10 to the minus 21, 10 to the minus 21 Tesla per root hertz. And so that's why often noise figures are quoted into, so a noise figure of a magnetic field is often quoted in Tesla per root hertz. And the root hertz is just coming from this fact that that at long integration times you can you get better sensitivity up to a point. So this formula is incredibly powerful because, in fact, most of the irreducible noise of all of these experiments is limited by thermal noise or the standard quantum limit. Even, in fact, about half the noise budget in LIGO is given by the thermal fluctuations of the coating in the mirrors or the suspension system. Likewise, the lasers used to stabilize the cavities used to stabilize the lasers in atom interferometers have some thermal noise. So so as long as you know and so spin resonance systems as well, because spins dephase via collisions, which you can think of them as coupling to some BAF. So for all of these systems, you can use the fluctuation dissipation theorem to calculate one irreducible source of noise.
What Q did you assume?
Oh, sorry, 10 to the 6. So I assumed, an inductor of a micro Henry, which is roughly what you get for a meter-sized pickup loop, a frequency of 100 megahertz, 1 Kelvin. I evaluated it at the resonant frequency. But you see, it's not resonant enhanced. There's no Lorentzian here. So the pickup area was a meter and a Q factor of 10 to the 6. That gives you about this value. It turns out that the axion at 100 megahertz is not quite, it's not a monochromatic wave. In fact, it has some coherence time. And so this minimum detectable frequency changes a little bit. So instead of going like root integration time, it goes like the fourth root of the coherence time, and then the fourth root of the integration time. And the coherence time at 100 megahertz is about 10 to the minus 2 seconds. So you have to integrate quite a bit to get to this, to get to 10 to the minus 21 Tesla levels.
Maybe silly question, but what is standard model physics?
Oh, sorry, the standard model physics is just the known set of physical laws.
So it keeps moving. It's a boundary that keeps changing.
Yeah, once we find, the pace of progress is sort of glacial, but yes. Once we find something new, soon after that, it becomes part of the standard model. Yes.
People think that's, why is it so complicated? People think eventually we'll know all the...
It depends on what you can access. We generally believe there's physics at much higher energy scales. Typically, as we move a decade in energy, we find a new particle, like the top quark or the Higgs boson. Those were the most recently discovered ones. But it's possible we missed something at very low energy. So this, these frontiers, and in some aspects, the cosmic frontier, is looking at lower energy processes, but at much weaker coupling. So we might have missed stuff at low energy. So there's this multi-dimensional parameter space, but you can project it on coupling versus energy. And so this is the sensitivity frontier, is looking at things that are not part of our set of physical laws at extremely weak coupling. Yeah.
So you concluded with this very nice general sort of framework to mm-hmm. really see, kind of guide these experiments and get them down to this fundamental limit. Mm-hmm. Some of them are already achieving it.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the money still on the table? Like, which of these is actually most promising if, sort of on 5 to 10 years in terms of it, yielding maybe some experimental results of interest?
I don't have a good answer. There's many of them. It depends on which theoretical target you think is more interesting. And it also depends on, a lot of these things are still under development. For example, the spin resonance techniques, usually NMR is done to do MRI or medical imaging and not so much for looking for dark matter fields, right? So the technology is quite young, and one may not achieve the ultimate sensitivity given by the fluctuation dissipation theorem. There's all sorts of other systematics, like real B fields in your superconducting shield that may fluctuate. So I don't have a clear-cut answer. I think these experiments are cheap enough, with the exception of LIGO, that you can put efforts in all of these categories.
So none of them are maxed out at present?
Sorry?
So none of them are maxed out at present?
No. A few of them, for example, the cavity experiments, some of them have achieved, in particular the Haystack experiment and the ADMX experiment is very close. So they've achieved this limit here where, you know, the Q factor of their cavity is about 10 to the 6. And they've achieved, you know, they've cooled down to low enough temperature that they're at the standard quantum limit. So, you know, they can improve their sensitivity by building multiple experiments, but that's a pretty slow scaling. You can also beat this standard quantum limit by using some fancy techniques, and I think they're working on that. For example, I mean, really what this is about is, you know, this resonant system you can think of as, again, a harmonic oscillator, you know, with some energy levels. And what it's saying is that the ground state of the system has some spread. So, for example, I mean, this is an LC circuit, but for a mechanical oscillator, you know, the position, what you're trying to measure is, let's say, a force, and you're trying to measure the displacement, but there's some zero-point uncertainty in the displacement. But that's, of course, just in the ground state. You can prepare a special state, which is a squeezed state, which has a narrower uncertainty spread. And so the Haystack experiment is working on squeezing the photon state in their cavity to have lower amplitude noise at the expense of larger phase noise.
There's an idea to use a really low energy nuclear transition in thorium as a nuclear clock.
Yes.
Is that trying to increase Q or decrease the temperature?
It's that one doesn't quite fall under this fluctuation dissipation theorem, but it is true. So when I said you can look for moduli here. Just to back up for a second, so this thorium transition would be a nuclear transition that's of order 7 eV or so, right? And the Q factor, if you measure the Q factor, this would be, let's say, the energy, which is 7 eV, divided by the lifetime. And in that sense, this Q factor is enormous. This Q, so 7 eV divided by the radiative width. The radiative width, I think, is expected to be 1,000 seconds. So in that sense, the Q factor would be 10 to the 19 or so. But when I said you can look for moduli, these moduli, they don't excite this. So the resonance for exciting this level, that would have a resonant enhancement factor by this number. But these moduli, they would be much lower frequency, and what they modulate is the splitting. So they would measure, they would modulate the transition energy. So the hope is that you can build a clock, so a laser that interrogates this transition, and that measures the splitting very accurately. But it's not like the moduli is exciting resonantly this transition. You could do that too, but the absorption cross section is quite small because it's a nuclear system.
Yeah. How much of what you wrote down on the left side of the board is actually driven by what you can write on the middle side of the board? In a sense, you know, there's a big question mark here, and there was the question about what's beyond the standard model. A lot of that, I guess, can be tested with these experiments, but then there's probably
right.
A lot of other things that can't.
Right. Actually, so, you know, within the confines of quantum field theory, there's not that many things you can write down here if you enforce minimality. So for dark matter, for example, if it's lighter than 10 eV, then it has to be a boson. Otherwise, you can't fit enough particles within a dwarf galaxy, say. So it has to be a boson, and so the possibilities are that it's parity odd, parity even. It could be a mixture of the two, or for spin 0 or spin 1. And it turns out that at low energies, you can classify which are the most important couplings. So you can write down the leading operator for a modulus to electrons, to nuclei, and to photons. Those are the three particles we care about at low energies. Same for an axion, and anomalies dictate what couplings you can write down for hidden photons, again, by sort of interaction strength in effective field theory. It turns out that all of the possible couplings, so there's three couplings of the axion, roughly speaking, three couplings for a moduli, and only a handful of anomaly-free couplings of a dark photon at leading order that you can write down. And in principle, you can look for all of those couplings here. So if that were not the case, I mean, I'd still tell you to look where you can. But yeah, in that sense, we're sort of lucky. But we don't know how weak the coupling is. So it could be way weaker than we could possibly achieve any time in the future. But we should try. Yeah.
Another question. Yeah. One of the difficulties in going to very low noise using ultra-high Q is in fact that the experiment is at ultra-high Q, namely it usually has a very limited dynamic range over which to search, and most models have very little theoretical underpinning, so looking for inflationary signatures, mm-hmm. looking for axions are good examples of not knowing theoretically where to look.
Right.
And so experiments are done where people have the ability to do that. So in the axion case, look at where you can build cavities and build quantum-limited detectors. Mm-hmm. But it forces you into a range where it's literally glacially slow to make progress.
So I think one point I was trying to make is that, yeah, so you lose off-resonance, you lose this amplification part. But that doesn't necessarily mean that so the natural amplification by the system itself. But that doesn't necessarily mean you can only look in a small fractional bandwidth around the resonance of your resonator. You can, in fact, look way far off resonance, because the thermal noise, in principle, is a broadband source of noise. In particular, there's other methods of amplifying it. For example, I can put an input inductor here, and if I have a different ratio of turns of a solenoid, I can amplify this signal and then feed it with another inductor to some little squid. And in principle, I can do multiple versions of this transformer circuits and multiply the voltage for each transformer circuit. So that's a way in which I amplify the signal. I can only do this to some extent because my squid has resistive junctions and because they're resistors, they will fluctuate also. And the more I amplify the signal, the more the squid will back react on the system. But for a quantum limited squid, you can achieve thermal noise sensitivity over this broad bandwidth. It can be, it depends on how well you can achieve this, but in principle, you can do it over an order one bandwidth. Yeah, so it's not necessarily, a high Q resonator is not necessarily a small dynamic range detector.
Any more questions? Okay, thanks a lot.